This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. A rare bipartisan commitment between the White House and congressional makes a sweeping agreement on infrastructure and dramatically collapsed. As AP Sagar Magani reports, the president walked out of a meeting after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said he was involved in a cover-up of his actions in the Russia probe.
It lasted all of 3 minutes.
To watch what happened in the White House would make your jaw drop.
It was very, very, very strange.
Sources say President Trump walked in, told Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi there would be no negotiating while Democrats investigate him, and then walked into the Rose Garden, where reporters who'd been urgently summoned minutes earlier waited.
Let them play their games.
He's furious over Pelosi saying hours earlier he'd engaged in a Russia probe cover-up. The Democrats, though, say it was all staged, an excuse not to talk about infrastructure.
He had to run away.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
A federal judge has ruled that President Trump and his family must turn over bank records from two of Mr. Trump's major lenders at Deutsche Bank and Capital One Bank, clearing the way for the banks to comply with congressional subpoenas for the records. AP's Mike Rossi has details.
U.S. District Judge Edgardo Ramos has refused to block subpoenas from two House panels seeking financial records from two banks that did business with President Donald Trump. Trump and his company filed a lawsuit arguing the subpoenas from the House Financial Services and Intelligence Committees were unlawful and unconstitutional. But in a ruling delivered from the bench in New York, Ramos concluded the subpoenas have legitimate legislative purpose. Lawyers for the two committees say they need the documents from Deutsche Bank and Capital One to investigate possible foreign influence in the U.S. political process. I'm Mike Rossia.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Indonesian President Joko Widodo says he will not tolerate anyone disturbing the country's democratic process after deadly clashes between police and supporters of Prabowo Subianto, the former army general who lost the election but is contesting the results. Reuters correspondent Francesca Lina reports at least six people were killed and more than 200 injured in the violence Wednesday.
Supporters of the opposition candidate Prabowo Subianto were met with tear gas on Wednesday. They threw fireworks and debris in return. The country had been awaiting official results since the April 17th election. But on results day, Subianto refused to concede defeat. He said he believes there had been widespread cheating in the polls and was making legal efforts to, quote, defend the mandate of the people. An election supervisory agency said there was a lack of evidence to support claims of systematic cheating. And independent observers have said the poll was free and fair.
That is Reuters' Francesca Lina reporting. The Pentagon is set to brief the White House on possible sending thousands more U.S. troops to the Middle East amidst rising tensions between Iran and Washington. The request from U.S. Central Command will be presented to the White House on Thursday. It is not clear if the White House will approve sending all or just some of the requested defensive forces, as well as additional Patriot missile batteries and more ships. Tensions between Tehran and Washington have been escalating since U.S. President Donald Trump announced his decision to try to cut Iran's oil exports to zero and beef up U.S. military presence in the Gulf in response to what he said were Iranian threats. At least three people were killed and 15 others injured Wednesday when Taliban insurgents detonated a vehicle-borne bomb in eastern Afghanistan. A suicide bomber driving a stolen explosive-laden Humvee military vehicle detonated his bomb when police forces tried to stop him at a security compound in the provincial capital of Ghazni. The chief of security directorate in Ghazni said that the blast killed two police officers and a child, while rescue teams transported 15 injured people to the hospital, including 10 civilians. And foreign ministers of Pakistan and India met informally Wednesday on the sidelines of a meeting of a regional countries in Kyrgyzstan. It is the first contact between the two nuclear-armed South Asian rival nations since they stepped back from the brink of war in February. The Pakistani official said the foreign minister of Pakistan briefly interacted with his Indian counterpart at the end of the two-day ministerial meeting at Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a China-led security bloc. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 23rd. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's election results are expected today, but the main opposition candidate is warning against rigging the vote.
I warned against those officials that are messing with the result sheets and then the attempts of those that would want to show that more people have voted than have been registered.
Lazaro Chakwera is the presidential candidate of the opposition Malawi Congress Party. Cameroon denies its soldiers killed a four-month-old baby. Roman Catholic bishops in East Africa call for disarming cattle herders. And South Africa will extradite a former Mozambican finance minister, but not to the United States.
I'm 100% sure that all different official departments, including the Attorney General office, is very happy with the outcome announced last night by the minister.
Fernando Lima is a Mozambican political commentator, and our African languages series continues this morning with a focus on the tweet language of Ghana. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi's Electoral Commission is expected to release more results today, Thursday, from Tuesday's presidential and parliamentary elections. Commission Chairperson Jean Ansah said Wednesday that transmission problems has slowed the vote counting process. Preliminary results released on Wednesday showed President Peter Mutharika and Lazaro Chakwera of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party were equal with about 37% of the vote. Chakwera says he was leading on Wednesday in the count and warned against any attempt to rig the vote.
Oh, we're doing very well. Even though just about a third of the results have come in and over half of the South has been counted, and I'm slightly leading, we believe that when the rest of the results come in, it will be pretty evident that we've carried the day.
Now, on Wednesday, you warned against attempts to rig the election. Exactly what were you trying to say?
Oh, yes, I warned against those officials that are messing with the results sheets and writing stuff that shouldn't be written, and then the attempts of those that would want to show that more people have voted than have been registered. And so I warned against anyone trying to break the law, because the law will catch up with them, and it's criminal to do stuff like that.
Suppose you do not win, will you accept, and do you plan to go to court when you talk about the law?
We'll cross that bridge when we get to it, but I just sounded that warning. Nobody should be able to have such impunity when these things concern Malawians.
What can you tell us, sir, about the overall conduct of the elections on the part of the Elections Commission? How do you think the whole process was conducted?
I think the commission is doing its best, and they're trying to contain whatever is happening, trying to respond to questions. There's definitely been places where the conduct of some of their hired officials has not been quite exemplary.
What do you mean, sir?
I mean when, for example, a returning officer refuses to make available all of the results sheets, which every monitor is supposed to have one.
Malawi has this winner-take-all system.
Yes.
Do you think someone is going to win, or do you think you are going to win because we're too many candidates in this election?
Yeah, there's too many candidates, but there's only one winner eventually. We do expect that the final result will be in our favor. We wait for the commission's press conference tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Because if a third of the results have been shared with the nation, by the time the night is over and part of the morning is done, we should have pretty much everything come in.
You had the former president, Joyce Banda, supporting you. Do you think her support was helpful to you?
Well, I think so. We will see what the final figures are. But her endorsement of my candidature certainly helped, and she campaigned in my behalf.
Lazarus Chakwera is the presidential candidate of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. South Africa's justice minister says Mozambique's former finance minister will be extradited to his home country instead of to the United States, as requested by U.S. officials, to face charges for his alleged involvement in a $2 billion loan scandal that crippled Mozambique's economy. But in Mozambique, critics and rights campaigners say they fear he may face a soft landing. Viewers Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Home again for Manuel Chang. So says South Africa's justice minister in a surprise late-night announcement that could bring Chang's six-month limbo in a South African jail cell to an end. Former Mozambican finance minister, who was arrested while traveling through Johannesburg in December, is wanted by both the United States and his native Mozambique for his alleged role in the debt scandal that has wrought economic chaos in the southern African nation. The U.S. and Mozambique filed petitions to extradite Chang, and a Johannesburg court last month referred it to South Africa's justice minister, Michael Masuta, who said in his statement that he was satisfied that the interests of justice will be best served by acceding to the request by the Republic of Mozambique. U.S. officials declined to comment when contacted by VOA. Chang faces a mixed reception at home. While the Mozambican government wants him back, most citizens do not, as they fear he will not face the same level of scrutiny he would in an American court, says prominent Mozambican political commentator Fernando Lima.
I'm 100% sure that all different official departments, including the Attorney General office, is very happy with the outcome announced last night by the minister. On the opposite, the popular reaction has been very, very negative.
The secret loan scam led the coastal nation to suffer a debt crisis so severe it has deprived citizens of the most essential services, like road maintenance and well-maintained hospitals. It's not clear what charges Chang would face in Mozambique. South African prosecutors say they did not receive a Mozambican charge sheet. The U.S. indictment issued by the Eastern District of New York accuses Chang and others of intentionally diverting portions of the loan proceeds to pay at least $200 million in bribes and kickbacks to themselves, Mozambican government officials, and others. Human Rights Watch researcher Zenaida Machado told VOA that she feels the venue of Chang's trial is irrelevant. She says what matters is that he faces a fair trial.
I'm not sure if the point is whether he's sent to Mozambique or to the U.S., and I would really avoid having that type of conversation because it kind of suggests that one country or another is better for human rights, which is not the point of the work we do. What I would prefer to focus on is on the need to hold people accountable for the damage they have caused to millions of Mozambicans.
The government has arrested about 20 people in connection with the scandal in recent months, but no one has been tried. In fact, Machado said it's not clear what will happen to Chang once he returns home.
The immunity must be removed from him. So the appeal we have for the parliament is that they do what they should do, which is to allow the authorities to arrest Mr. Chang and to take him to justice so he has his chance to prove whether he's innocent or not.
In the meantime, as questions swirl around him and the legal process continues, Chang remains in the same place he's been for nearly 6 months, a jail cell. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The separatist war in parts of Cameroon took a gruesome turn this week with the shooting death of a four-month-old baby. A rights group blames the army for the death, but the government says it was the work of the separatist. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
It is a sad atmosphere in the southwestern town of Moyuka as people brave a heavy military presence to visit Emilia Agbo 2 days after her baby girl was killed in the family home. Funineba, the baby's father, says the military attacked their neighborhood on May 21 and killed his child.
My wife was preparing food. The child was sleeping. I was in front of the door. Six armor cars just bashed in. Flow bullet, brrr, everywhere the places. My wife took off, but there was no way to come and collect the child. So after all the shooting all along, the ministry man mashed the door, shot the child, and he said, these are the remaining bullets here.
The death of the baby has provoked anger among locals. Maximilian Gombe, coordinator of the Network of Human Rights Defenders in Central Africa, says the group believes the baby's killer was from Cameroon's military. She says it is very difficult, if not impossible, for separatist fighters to operate and leave Moyoka, which is excessively militarized, without being traced by the military. She says the bullets found near the murdered baby are not those made locally as used by the separatist fighters. In a statement Wednesday, government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi denied the military was responsible. He blamed the separatists, saying they initiated the killing to discredit the government after some of their peers surrendered. Sadi said the bullets found near the baby were planted there to make it look like the military's doing. Meanwhile, a male head was discovered Tuesday in the English-speaking town of Bamenda, triggering gunfire and general panic. It was identified as that of a teacher. The incident took place a day after Cameroon celebrated Unity Day on May 20. Separatists vowed to shut down any celebrations of the event, prompting the government to deploy extra troops, saying they were needed to protect civilians. Humanitarian worker and pastor Theodore Ngek says the deployment, attacks on suspected separatist hideouts, and the gruesome killings have provoked a mass movement of people.
Vous avez dans une petite ville comme Banga, vous vous retrouvez avec 5,000 personnes supplémentaires d'entre.
He says in less than a week, more than 500 people have added to the nearly 5,000 IDPs that have arrived in the French-speaking town of Manga from the war-torn English-speaking regions. He says a majority of them sleep in the open on pieces of paper, while some few lucky ones who can afford to rent rooms lack food to eat. He says all of them are traumatized from hearing gunshots and trekking long distances. Human rights groups have accused security forces of targeting civilians in the far north, where Cameroon is fighting Boko Haram, and in the northwest and southwest regions, where the military is battling English-speaking separatists trying to create a breakaway nation. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 23rd, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Roman Catholic bishops in Kenya, Uganda, and Ethiopia have called for a coordinated and peaceful disarmament of cattle herders in the region. The Border Triangle is the homeland to many herder groups, including the Turkana and the Pokot of Kenya, the Karamoja of Uganda, the Sanix of Ethiopia, and the Topasa of South Sudan. These groups have for many centuries raided each other's cattle as part of an age-old tradition. But the bishops said cattle raiding in the recent past has turned deadly and led to insecurity in the region. They called on the regional governments to launch a simultaneous disarmament process. Monsignor Matthew Odong is the vicar of the Archdiocese of Guru in Uganda.
These nomads who go around using guns to raid the cattle, they inflict sufferings on the people, and they deprive the people of their right to own cattle. That is number one. And then a call for disarmament is to provide a permanent solution to this problem. It is a real social problem, an economic problem. Because people who keep cattle here, they use them for various economic reasons. So if the raiders, they go and then steal and rob all these cattle, they leave the people in abject poverty. That is the reason why the bishop of Kenya, Ethiopia, and Uganda are calling for disarmament.
Monsignor, you just touched on one of the key reasons these herders carry guns, and that is to protect their cattle. If you take away the guns, how are they going to protect their cattle?
If you take away the guns from all of those who believe that the guns is the means to rob cows, then you solve the problems. Then nobody will go to rob the cows from the herders. From whom are they protecting their cows? From those who have the guns. So the guns should actually be removed from all of them.
You say that the cycle of violence has created insecurity in the area. Do you think disarming is the way, or you got to go to the source where the guns are coming from? Because one thing is that these guns seem to be coming from, say, countries like South Sudan. A rifle, about $200 to $300 to buy one. Do you take away the guns from the herders, or you go to the source of the guns?
Well, but we have to address the root cause, especially those who make guns available to those cattle raiders. That is now becomes a political, in the sense that it will need a collective effort of all these countries to put some embargo and sanction against the country that allows the sale of guns to the other tribes because of the effects of inflicting sufferings on the innocent people. So it is not just removing the guns, but also addressing the root cause or addressing those leaders, those countries which provide the guns.
The bishops say that peaceful disarmament begins with the transformation of the individual and disarming the mind and the heart. Is this going to be simultaneous?
Every tribe belongs to a country, and it is the responsibility of each country actually to educate the mind and the heart of their people to abstain from violence and inflicting sufferings on the others. The greatest commandment, do unto others what you would wish be done unto you. This is where it should begin. If you don't want to be killed and then you go around killing others, then you are not doing justice. That is selfishness.
Monsignor, thank you for speaking to us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you. Together we can make America and Africa great again.
Monsignor Matthew Odong is the vicar of the Archdiocese of Gulu. You were speaking with me from Gulu in northern Uganda. South Sudan President Salva Kiir commented publicly for the first time this week about calls for protests to oust his government, as was done in neighboring Sudan, where months of protests led to the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir. Winnie Sirino reports from Juba.
In remarks at an event launching the South Sudan's international communication system, President Salva Kiir urged the country's youth to focus on building the country rather than engaging in more fighting and causing more chaos in the country. He also warned young people against misusing social media.
You are being aided by the social media from abroad. That Amchul Mazarat.
You are being urged by social media from abroad to go and demonstrate. If you are told to demonstrate against the government, don't they know that in demonstrations people can die if the government just close up their mind and hold you down by automatic weapons? Why should you die? We don't do that. And I will not order the soldiers to shoot you down.
Mr. Kiir says South Sudanese fought several years for independence, which eventually occurred in 2011 when South Sudan broke away from Sudan. He says South Sudanese should ignore previous calls by the online group, the Red Card Movement, to stage mass protests against the Kiir administration, similar to what happened in neighboring Sudan.
The youth should not be lured into fighting because of ranks, because of whatever. Military ranks, what are they? If you have not been there, please concentrate on what we are launching today. This is where you will progress. In fighting, you will never progress. So let us really concentrate on peace.
Speaking at the same event, Information Minister Michael Makwee said some South Sudanese are exploiting the ignorance of a majority of the population by spreading disinformation on the internet to cause intercommunal conflicts.
We have seen the misuse of ICT by those who are living outside the country, where they conveniently exploit our lack of access to information.
Makwee says South Sudan's first so-called information gateway should have been constructed in 2007, but was delayed because of technical problems. He says today's communication system was established under a public-private partnership with international partners experienced in telecommunications under a shared revenue agreement with the South Sudan government. The Minister of Information, Communication and Technology says his office recently awarded licenses to a number of companies to begin installing fiber optic cable from the Ugandan border to Juba to increase electronic communication for the government and to promote e-commerce. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sirino in Juba.
This year is the year of indigenous languages, and language activists in Africa are working to put the spotlight on the threats that local languages face and what that means to the people in their regions. To learn more about some of these languages, Reiki Stryak has a five-part series that explores five different West African languages and the people who are trying to make sure that these languages thrive. For the second installment, Stryak spoke to Ursula Zage, an advocate for the Tweet language of Ghana.
So currently we have about 58% of Ghanaians Twee and about 30% of Cote d'Ivoireans who speak the language. So the problem with the Twee language is that many Ghanaians can speak it, but when it comes to writing, it becomes very difficult for them to write because we are taught English in school and we are taught many languages in English instead of we being taught in English and a local language, so that when we come out, we are not only conversant with English, but we are conversant with English and another local language. Yes, so that is the problem that we have now.
What made you decide to get into this kind of advocacy work?
Okay, so when I had the opportunity to attend Wikimania last year, I had the privilege of interacting with some participants from Africa and South Africa and Nigeria, to be precise. And I was so impressed with the way that they were able to get more people in their communities to contribute content on Wikipedia, not only in English, but their native language like Igbo. If you want to invite more people to join this digital world, people like those in the villages, those in rural areas who do not speak English well, who do not understand English well, but their local languages, if you want them to come online, then there should be some content in the languages that they can understand.
And how do you balance promoting indigenous languages within a community and also the opportunity that is provided by perhaps a more globally spoken language such as English?
I think it's good to know English, but at the same time, I feel it's important for you to know your indigenous languages. So what I'm looking at is maybe 15 years from now or 10 years from now, when we are gone, and then a new generation sets in. And let's say the world goes, everything has gone digital. What is the proof that there existed some different languages? Because the people that used to speak them are no more. And now documentations are being done digitally. But because we are so much focused on the English language, we forgot to document in other languages. So there will be no proof of the existence of those languages, and these languages will just diminish. Yeah, so I think it's very important. English is important, but then it's also important that we preserve our indigenous languages.
That was Ursula Zage, an advocate for the Twi language. She was speaking to Reiki Stryak from Ghana's capital, Accra. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Malawi's Electoral Commission is expected to release more results today, Thursday, from Tuesday's presidential and parliamentary elections. Commission Chairperson Jean Ansa said Wednesday that transmission problems have slowed the vote counting process. Preliminary results released on Wednesday show President Peter Mutharika and Lazarus Chakwera of the main opposition Malawi Congress Party were equal with about 37% of the vote. Chakwera says he was leading on Wednesday in the count and warned against attempts to rig the vote. The United States says it is greatly disappointed with South Africa's decision to send a former Mozambican finance minister back home instead of the United States, to stand trial for alleged fraud. That's it for this Thursday, May 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Yes, sir.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1500 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.